Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Heritage Radio Network on Tour, presented by Le Creuset. I'm Dana Cowan, and today we're broadcasting live from HRN Podcast Lounge at Feast Portland. We want to thank our sponsors, Le Creuset, Travel Portland, Salt and Straw, and the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage possible. Today I have an extraordinary guest who has a very special name, because it's mine.
Same name.
Dana Frank from Bar Norman, who all of you in Portland know is one of the most amazing natural wine bars anywhere in the country. We just happen to be in Portland. So welcome, Dana.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here. This gorgeous weather.
Yes. So for those of you listening who are not in these tents, it is pouring down rain and muddy underfoot. But we are in a tent. And
it's quintessentially Portland.
So I feel like I'm feeling it.
Exactly, right?
And last night I was at Bar Norman, so I got to experience your beautiful hospitality and incredible wine. Can you tell me a little bit about the birthing of Bar Norman and why you chose to create that bar?
I have spent the majority of my career working in hospitality, working in restaurants, and but with an emphasis on wine. Running wine programs and working as a sommelier, but I've done everything. Been a general manager. I got my start cooking, so that's really how I got into the business. And I think after, kind of working my way up over years, I was ready to do my own thing. And I love natural wine. It's been sort of a very big part of my life since I started working in wine. And so I just wanted to find a way to bring a space to Portland that felt comfortable and fun and vibrant like a bar, but it was about wine and not about cocktails and not about beer. And that was something really new for Portland because we're such a beer and cocktail city. And so the idea was just to, bring that sort of idea, but have it be about wine.
Okay, so many questions. So you said you've been in love with natural wine really for a good long time.
Yeah.
A lot of the country and the world has caught up with you.
Yes.
What was it like back then when you were, a lonely natural wine warrior? And what do you think changed?
I think, I think that I sort of came into natural wine at the same time that it was starting to happen in New York and, starting to happen a little bit in Oakland. But really, for me, it was traveling and drinking wine in places like Paris and drinking wine in London and realizing that the world of wine is so big, and I just had an affinity for these wines, mostly because of one importer, because of Louis Dresner. Those were the first natural wines that I drank, where the light bulb went off for me, and I was like, okay, there's something happening here that I've not experienced in wine before. The wines to me were more authentic and sort of interesting, and there was more of a story to uncover.
Do you feel like they seemed more authentic because they had a greater sense of terroir, which would be sort of funny, right? Because the whole, when people are getting geeky about wine, they're like, oh my God, I can taste the rubble.
Yeah.
But in some way, you're like, it's beyond the rubble.
Yeah, it is for sure. I mean, I think terroir has a place and it's an important part of the discussion. But I think, what I've learned is it's farming and it's the people behind the wines. And for whatever reason, with natural wines, whether they're good or they're flawed, there's a story behind all of them, which is not to say with conventional wine there isn't also a story, but maybe the stories were just more compelling to me. And I definitely felt when I got started I was sort of like out on a limb, mm-hmm. just sort of figuring it out. But because I had sort of seen that there were all these other places in the world that were embracing these wines, and that the Loire Valley had been making these wines, and the Republic of Georgia had been making these wines for so long, that it was only new here. You know, it's something that's been going on for a long time. So I always like being sort of on the edge of things. It's harder, but I like it.
So Louis Dresner, was there one wine in that portfolio that you remember that was sort of your conversion wine?
Yeah. It was I don't remember the vintage. I'm actually really terrible about remembering vintages. As a wine person, that's embarrassing to admit, but very true. But it was Domaine de Clausel Sauvignon, Chenin Blanc. And my now husband and I were at a tasting of Louis Dresner wines, and there were all of these Loire Valley growers there. And Clausel was there, and we were talking, and they wanted to know if we had worked with Sauvignon, we knew about Sauvignon. And we said, oh, maybe we know about Sauvignon. We really like Chenin Blanc, but we don't work with any Sauvignon. And she said, oh, you must be so sad. And the light bulb went on. I was like, yeah, why am I'm missing something here. Like, I don't know about this wine and I want to know more. And so yeah, that was one of the first wines for me. The Loire Valley in general was sort of the like mind-blowing moment learning about the Loire.
Right. At Food and Wine, when we ask people, you know, what's your favorite region, and you expect a diversity of answers.
Yeah.
You know, someone's going to love Bordeaux and somebody's going to love, you know, whatever. But we kept getting Loire.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah. I think the diversity of wines in the Loire is what makes the region so dynamic. One, it's a very big region. But you have white wines, red wines, rosés, you have skin contact wines, you have sparkling wines, table wines, sweet wines. And there aren't very many other places in the world where one region encapsulates so many different styles of wine. And so I think that's part of it. I think, you know, sitting along a river, this long east to west meandering river is really incredible. And then the history of the Loire, like its vineyards and then castles and tiny villages, and it's just a really magical place for a lot of different reasons. And I think that's why it captures so many people's attention.
Right, there's a lot of ways to capture imagination in the Loire. Yep. You know, you could love it for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And always have a glass of wine in your hand.
Yes, 100%.
There are a lot of people who are fearful is too strong a word, but are dismissive of natural wine because they've had so many flawed wines.
Yep.
And the notion of having an orange wine is like, really? Because that seems extremely pretentious.
Yes, I agree.
So in introducing people to natural wine, do you think that you need to adjust your palate, your expectations? Like, what should someone who's approaching a natural wine list, like, what should go through their mind?
I think the open mind is probably the key. And I often try and explain to people, like, when you start drinking wine for the first time, you've never tasted wine before, you might not really like it, right? It's a lot of different sensations. I think most people, when they drink coffee for the first time, want to know why the hell you would want to drink coffee, right? It's like bitter and it's strong and it's acidic. And it's something that for most of us, our palates aren't used to. And I think wine is the same way. And so it's just saying like, okay, this is something new that I haven't tasted before. And it's just different than conventional wine. So saying like, I'm going to train my palate to get used to tasting something that is maybe higher acidity or more phenolic, more grapey tasting, or more tannic or more sour, you know, whatever the adjectives are. Getting used to it, I think, is the most important.
So I have had some really horrible natural wine experiences.
Yes, I have too.
And, you know, like between being too funky or
yes.
too acidic or just actually tasting off.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't buy into this new thing. And then, like Alice Firing,
yeah.
you know, like picked out some wines for me and like, these are actually really good.
Yeah.
So it opened my mind like a crack. And
yeah.
then I was in Paris and, being in Paris, all the wines were natural wines.
Yeah.
And they were like, my mind just flipped.
Yeah.
Completely.
And all of a sudden it was different.
All
yeah.
of a sudden it was different. And I was like,
yeah.
I've missed something. And then conventional wines taste too heavy, too round.
Yep.
You know, not enough acid.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden I'm craving this much, and again, maybe it was the time of year, everything is so much lighter, so much racier, and so much more pleasing.
Yeah.
And I was excited to be able to have that experience. We had Pet Sounds.
Yes. Yeah, that's such a delicious Oregon wine. I'm so glad you drank that.
It was fantastic. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So Pet Sounds is made by a woman named Jess Miller, who is a really, really incredible story. She is a farmer first, which, you know, sounds like most people that are making natural wine you would think are farmers. But in a lot of regions of the world, it's too expensive to own land. Like, if you don't have money or you're not born into a family that has land, it's not super easy just to go out and buy vineyard land. So you have a lot of people that make wine, but they purchase their fruit. So, you know, maybe they're working closely with a grower, so they have a real say over how the fruit is being grown, but they are purchasing it. They're not farming it themselves. Jess is a farmer. She had the extraordinary opportunity to work at Clos Roche Blanche, which is one of the most legendary and special natural wineries, amazing vineyard in the Loire Valley. So she did some farming there and a couple of other places, and then came to Oregon, and she farms here for some different people and also makes a little bit of her own wine. So that's the Pet Sounds is a Pet Nat made from Pinot Noir. And it's the most brilliant, gorgeous, pink, juicy, just delicious wine with like just a touch of sweetness. And it's perfectly balanced by the acidity. And it's just like a guzzler. You just want to drink it. And it's called Pet Sounds. And there's jellyfish on the label. And it's like all the things that you want. And I think it exemplifies really delicious, well-made natural wine, and that it's clean, it's free of flaws, but it's so so well farmed, and it checks off all the marks for natural wine. You know,
it was perfect. And as you say, like in this really comfortable, relaxing setting with some brass candlesticks, you know, a glass of pink wine in front
That's
of you,
great.
And like
I think, you know, it's for me my biggest goal now where I'm at in my career is about making wine accessible and making wine approachable. And I think that is sort of the next kind of frontier for wine and for natural wine specifically. And when you think back to the history of natural wine, like it is a beverage that was on the table. It was not anything aristocratic until you got maybe to Burgundy and Bordeaux and Sauternes and Tokai, but it was not aristocratic, right? It was wine that was just, it was a beverage that was on the table. People came in from working in the vineyards or, you know, from in the town at their bakery or, you know, their meat shop, and they just had wine on the table. And we've gotten really far away from that. And so my goal is like, how do we get back to that place where there's wine of all different price points in all different sorts of environments and atmospheres where no matter how you feel about it, you can drink it and enjoy it. So
you were talking about like bringing it to the table, right?
Yeah.
And wine and food work really well together.
Yes, they do.
And you published a book, I think it was last year.
Yes, just a year ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was Wine and Food Together.
Yes.
And one of your goals with that book was to show a lot of different ranges and styles of wine. And I actually of the belief that, 25% of pairings, maybe 10% of pairings just are horrible, and
Agreed.
10% of pairings are really brilliant and worth worrying about.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of it, like, we should all just be drinking and eating.
Exactly. Yep.
But in the book, you expose people to different types of wine and then different pairings to just sort of make it easier,
yep.
as you say, to make it more accessible.
Yeah.
I mean, at the same time, knowing that, like, you're not really going to go so hard wrong.
Right. Exactly.
I'm wondering from that book and from that experience, I mean, you're thinking about wine and food together all the time, maybe not at Bar Norman at this exact second,
right?
But you have in your whole
in
career.
General, yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, how should people think about putting those two things together?
There's two rules of thumb, and they sound funny when you say them together, but I think things that are opposite go really well together, and things that are similar go really well together. But it depends on what those similar things are. So, you know, when you think about spice and heat, things that kind of counterbalance that, so the opposite of that, are really great friends. So things that have fruitiness and a little residual sugar and a little sort of roundness are really great. So that's like an opposite sort of attract type of thing. And then in the, you know, when you think about like a grilled tomahawk steak, you know, something that is like charred and smoky and a little bit fatty, you want a wine that can kind of stand up to that. So you want, you know, a wine that's got some like body to it and some guts. So those are the similar things. The opposite part is you want a wine that also has acidity, so your palate stays really like fresh feeling and not tired. So it's like a red wine with body and guts to it, but also with acidity. So it's the opposite things and then the similar things and finding the balance in between.
Right. I love it when like wine's the thing that just clears all that fat away. You're I need some more wine.
Why would you drink water? You need wine. You need acid.
Exactly. And you talk about a lot of different types of wine. Like if people are, you know, they know something, but they want to go to the next level.
Yeah.
Like what do you think people should be drinking to just expand their minds a little more? Because I feel like that's part of the education, right?
Yeah.
Part of the education is just drink.
Yeah, for sure. That's the best way to learn.
And then go to a wine shop where you trust somebody and just say, like, this is what I'd like before. Find me something like it. And this is my price range. Be really bold.
Yep.
But I feel like there's the next level is actually really important. I feel like so much is discussed at the base level, and then so much is like at the super high end. Like,
and then what's in the middle?
Well, what's in the middle?
Yeah, I think finding confidence in your palate. So as you said, knowing what you like, what tastes good to you, and then saying, okay, so I figure that out. What's the next tier above that? So I know that I like Oregon Pinot Noir. I like wines that have a nice balance of fruit and earthiness. They have some acidity to them. They're not big, bold wines. So what's a new place that I can go from there? What's something that's sort of in that family and it takes you up to the next tier? In which case, I would recommend that you try Nebbiolo. So then Nebbiolo gets you into a different country, a different type of wine, a different grape, but it's similar enough that if you like Pinot Noir, you're probably going to like Nebbiolo. And then once you sort of like play around with Nebbiolo, where do you go from there? Well, you could try other red grapes that are grown in the Piedmont, where Nebbiolo is grown, and that takes you one direction. Or you could try another red grape that is, again, kind of similar, and you could try a Nerello Mascalese that comes from Sicily. So it's sort of like a spider webbing out from where you are.
I really love, love, love that as an idea, and I've never heard that described before. So you're taking the central flavor components and building on what appeals to your palate.
Exactly.
But moving you around the world because like you could just keep going in Pinot Noir.
Absolutely.
You could get deeper. So that's I guess one way. But
exactly.
It's super exciting to like switch the flavor profile a little bit.
Yeah, I mean if you take this example of Nebbiolo and you say, okay, I tried Nebbiolo and I like that. So now I want to try something else from a region that is similar but maybe not Nebbiolo and all of a sudden you get into Dolcetto or Barbera or you get even more interesting and you drink another indigenous red from the Piedmont, all of a sudden you're in a completely different style of wine and you've moved pretty far away from Pinot Noir by that point, but you've given yourself sort of the baby steps to get there rather than saying, I really like Pinot Noir, but people say I should try orange wine.
I really love that. What about a white? Like, give me a trajectory on a white.
So you are a fan of Sauvignon Blanc.
I love Sauvignon Blanc.
And let's say, let's say we'll be New World about it. You're a fan of like New Zealand or California style Sauvignon Blanc. So something that's a little bit more herbaceous, more grassy. So I would say a good place to go from there is like, oh, you might like Vermentino. Mm-hmm. And where does Vermentino grow? Well, traditionally it grows in Italy, coastal Italy. So let's take you to coastal Italy and you try some Vermentino. Oh, and all of a sudden Vermentino, it's coastal Italy. And if you just go a little bit further up the coast, you're in Liguria, which is all along the coast. And then you can try the grape Pigato, which grows right next to the Vermentino vines in Liguria. And all of a sudden now you're tasting a completely different grape from a different region that doesn't really taste like Sauvignon Blanc, but you've taken the step to get there by way of going through Vermentino.
Okay, I really love that as a flavor map. At the beginning of the podcast, you were talking about being on the edge.
Yeah.
You know, always like finding yourself there, sort of one way or another. And what do you feel like is the next edge?
Or for myself personally, or
exactly what are you experimenting?
You know,
with?
I to be perfectly honest, I am really loving and sort of reveling in my life as it is right now. I am in my 16th year of working in wine, and Bar Norman just celebrated a 1-year anniversary, And I'm a mom and a wife, and we have a couple of different wine businesses, and I'm really, really enjoying having one business to run and no extracurricular projects right now, and really settling into just my life as a career person. And my focus right now is so much more on mentoring and working with people who are coming up underneath who are younger. I'm 41 now, and I feel like I've been super fortunate to have had the mentors and the people that I've worked with and the amazing role models to look up to. And I'm not at all putting myself in that category, but I feel like it's just now it's time to start giving some of that back. And so I'm really lucky to have a staff of all young, vibrant, energetic people that have many more hours in the day of energy than I have. And so my goal is really to help them kind of find their way and what's the next steps for them, and sort of just enjoy where I'm at. And it feels really good.
And
there might be one or two projects in the works that are under the wraps, but nothing big.
I have to ask about wine and music.
Yeah.
And you're going to go way beyond my ability to understand anything, but you were, you know, opening up the floor for a dance party.
Yeah.
And your husband was like up in the crow's nest.
Yep.
Spinning some records, and you've done a pop-up that was like food and music.
Yep.
So what are the connections there? And
well, I mean, the main connection is the connection with my husband, with Scott, because he's the reason that my life is full of good music. And it, to me, is like there's no day without music in my life anymore. It's from the time we wake up until through all hours of the day, in the car, at home, at the bar. And, you know, part of setting up the bar was to us to have a place that was sort of like kind of our thing that we're going to do for a long time. It wasn't anything that we looked at as like, we're going to do this for a little while and then move on to something else. It's like, this is it. So what are the things that we care about the most? And it's wine and music, and how do we put those things together? And so we very much talk about the bar in terms of like, oh, it's good vibes because the wine's great and it's a lot of fun people that come hang out there, but also there's like a great hi-fi system and we play the music pretty loudly, and that's part of the vibe. Like if you go to a bar, a cocktail bar, or you go to a beer bar, it's loud, it's vibrant, it's vivacious. And so we're trying to create sort of the same thing. And the music, I think, in some regards is more crucial to that than anything else, you know, than to the bar feeling great is the music.
So on Heritage Radio Network, I host a show called Speaking Broadly.
Yes.
And on Speaking Broadly, I have a couple of questions that I ask every guest, and I'm just going to indulge myself here and ask you. And it's okay if you don't have an immediate answer. We can move on. Is there one thing, hopefully a product, that is better than the hype?
That's better than the hype. Oh my gosh, that's really tough to think that's better than the hype.
We can pause. I'll let you think about
that. Okay, I'm going to think on that. I'm going to come up with something.
And paying it forward, giving a shout out to a woman who you admire so much, who you want everyone to know about.
Can I have two people?
Yes, you may.
Okay. So one person would be my sister, Lindsay Corbin, who is 3 years younger than me and is truly like my hero. She's a professional athlete, and what I've learned from her is what it takes to compete at an elite level, not physically, but mentally and emotionally. She's just the strongest person that I know. And I have a huge amount of admiration for her dedication and her grit, and she just doesn't ever give up. The other person would be my dear, wonderful friend, Whitney Schubert, who lives in New York. She works for Polaner Selections, and she was one of the first women in wine who really inspired me and lit a fire under me to work harder and do better and keep learning. She's a, you know, dear, dear friend of mine, but I think has, for a lot of women in the business, sort of set the path for success and for constantly learning and asking questions and being curious. And she's a tireless advocate for the growers that she represents. And yeah, absolutely is, I think, one of the people that got me where I am.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. Product or we'll skip?
Product that is...
I'll give you an example.
Hyped and yeah.
So Marguerite Mariscal, who's the CEO of Dave Chang's empire, yep. chose the Mr. Clean eraser.
Oh my gosh, I love that magic eraser. It's so true. Okay, I have one though. I would say it's in the cleaning realm, but a Tide stick.
Really?
Because as a wine person, I would never, my staff has learned there's like a Tide stick in the desk upstairs, there's a Tide stick downstairs, there's a Tide stick in my bag, because you're gonna get red wine on yourself, or someone's gonna come to our bar and get red wine on them. And the Tide stick literally makes the wine disappear. It's not just like stain remover and then you wash it. I did it to one of my employees the other night and they couldn't believe the stain went away. So yeah, I would say that. It's okay. it's like the magic eraser for clothing.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you.
Worth the hype.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Dana Frank, for joining us. Thanks to all of you for listening to Heritage Radio Network on Tour, presented by Le Creuset. Thanks again to our supporters, Le Creuset, Travel Portland, The Salt and Straw, and the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage possible. I'm Dana Cowan. Stay tuned for more from a really beautiful but very rainy Feast Portland.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.